From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Michigan's Arab community rallies to oppose the Islamic State.
Who is behind them? Who is financing them? Who is giving them the support to do what they're doing? They're not alone.
A Michigan writer teams up with a world-renowned economist to write a book teaching kids about economics.
And ultimately, we felt that the best introduction of economics was to explain it with everyday scenarios. We absolutely agreed the word widget would not be in the book.
Red wine to chill or not to chill.
Red wines, we don't do it that often, and I think we should.
And we wrap up our new Michigan music series with Joe Hertler and the Rainbow Seekers.
You do this because you have something that you think is special, and you think, hopefully, people will actually get something out of it when they listen to it.
But first, the news. The White House is holding its summit on countering violent extremism this week.
We all are united against the ISIS. They do not represent Islam. They do not even represent humanity.
I'm Cynthia Canty. As violence continues in the Middle East, today on Stateside, we check in with Metro Detroit's Arab American community. But first, only one in three Michiganders feel that Michigan's statewide school system deserves a grade of A or B. That's according to new polling from Michigan Radio and public sector consultants. Representative Adam Zemke is the Democratic vice chair of the House Education Committee. He represents Ann Arbor, and he's with us now. Welcome, Representative.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. It's good to be here.
Are you surprised by these grades?
I was a bit surprised by the grades. I've just had a chance to take a look at some of the polling results that were shared, and I was surprised by the attitudes, kind of expressed through the polls by parents, a bit concerned. But I also started digging into the polls a little bit more, and I realized that it's going to be pretty hard to discern anything from these results. And I say that because it was the first question, how do folks feel about their neighborhood school, and how do folks feel about the schools on a statewide basis? And, they ranked them, but it didn't really ask why they felt that way. And in discussing the quality of our public schools, and getting feedback from parents, it's really important, but it's really important to understand why they're saying the things that they're saying. And so that's really the piece of information that maybe I'm just missing here. I don't know if it was asked or not. But that's what I'd like to understand a bit more of.
Well, let me just ask, get your perspective. Where do you think the biggest challenges lie right now in K through 12 education in Michigan?
I think there are many challenges. I think that it's really important to understand, that there are areas in our public schools that are not getting the resources that they need, and that we're having a very important discussion regarding school equity and funding equity in Lansing. And, 20 years, the 20-year anniversary of Proposal A is now upon us. And I think it's important to have a greater discussion about that as we go forward, because I think that the state is incenting some behaviors that are not always helpful to creating a positive public education experience for students statewide.
As we know, Republicans control the state House and Senate, and they have made it really clear their priorities when it comes to education are teacher evaluations and an A through F grading system for schools. Do you think you can find compromise on those positions?
Well, I think that both the House Democrats and House Republicans last term put together a very fair and funded proposal on how to improve and provide constructive evaluation support for educators. I say that, educators as both administrators and teachers, and I was part of that process. And, the package received 96 votes out of 110 in the House of Representatives, and so pretty substantive bipartisan support. In fact, it is the only legislation that received that degree of bipartisan support in the education realm last term.
Well, going forward, looking at the session ahead, Representative, what do you think could happen with these teacher evaluations or this A through F grading system?
Well, obviously we're hopeful for some additional items that were put forward by the Council on Educator Effectiveness. Dean Deborah Ball from the University of Michigan had some wonderful recommendations, and we're hoping to coalesce around some of those ideas. And I think on all of these issues, it's very important to, get feedback from parents, like you've done here, but really ask substantive questions about, where are areas that they're seeing deficiencies or things that need to be improved in our public schools, because simply asking them to rank schools is not really helping us in the legislature. Parents are, they have a great eye into our public school system that we in the legislature do not have necessarily. And really getting that feedback on a detailed basis as to why they're feeling that our public schools are receiving the grades they are is very important to the process. So I think that's something we really need to work on.
I'm speaking with Representative Adam Zemke, who's Democratic Vice Chair of the House Education Committee. There was a bill that was talked about a lot in the last session, essentially holding a third grader back in Michigan if that youngster doesn't meet certain standards for reading. The measure was introduced last session but stalled out. And I'm wondering, where does that stand now?
So the piece of legislation that was introduced last session, it was an area that I did not support. I believe that in order to support literacy and really improve literacy in Michigan, we need to provide that constructive support, really from before school kids enter our K-12 system, really in the preschool or even before that, in child care and in even prenatal care because of brain development. But, that being said, really the pre-P through 3, meaning preschool through third grade, and providing that constructive support to improve literacy is the area that I think we really need to focus on. And thankfully, there has been some additional discussion at the state about changing the literacy discussion to that area this time. So I'm hopeful that we'll come around to some agreement on doing that.
Adam Zemke, Democratic State Representative from Ann Arbor, who is Vice Chairman of the House Education Committee. We appreciate your insights.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. I appreciate the opportunity to be on.
And you can find full results of Michigan Radio and Public Sector Consultants' poll, part of our continuing series, Michigan's Pulse. It's at our website, michiganradio.org. While you're there, you can check out other stories and other interviews you may have missed. This is Fat Tuesday, and to many, especially in Michigan, that means punchki. The historically Polish treat is not just a jelly donut, say its legions of fans. It's wonderfully loaded with fat and sugar, the perfect way to indulge before the austerities of Lent kick in tomorrow with Ash Wednesday. For years, crowds have lined up at the new Martha Washington Bakery in Hamtramck, where Sandy Bakich is baking and baking. Sandy, how many punchki will you make this year?
Bosses don't tell me. When I was a young teen here, I had the privilege and pleasure to work with all the old-time bakers. When I would inquire, they would say, "Little one, that's not your business." So it always became a joke, and so I never asked after that.
Hundreds of dozens, I've got to imagine.
Probably.
A lot of butter and a lot of sugar.
Oh, yes.
Walk us through how you make a punchki.
A pure labor of love. You weigh the ingredients, mix them, wait. Punch it out, punch it, wait. Form it in big balls, wait. Form it in small balls, wait. Fry them, wait. Fill them, glaze them, and put them out for sale.
Well, Sandy, Hamtramck is really the epicenter of punchki and so much else, and you like to say the people there roar. What is it that you think makes Hamtramck so special?
The diversity, acceptance. We know it's always been diverse. It's always been the first. We're so small, and we can make things happen. Like for Punchki Day, we've always made punchki. When it started becoming big, we're looking at each other. It's like, what's so big deal about punchki? I grew up even in Europe on punchki. When we came to the United States, it was punchki. It was, it's, for us, it was nothing. But as soon as the media got a hold of it and the story behind, you know, Fat Tuesday, why punchki were made, everybody wanted to be Polish on punchki day.
It's pretty great. Yeah, cleaning out the larder before you have to start giving things up for Lent.
Well, that was the tradition. Today it's suicide if you use the lard. We use everything, pure vegetable shortenings.
Certainly. Your family hails from Serbia, and some of your bakers are Polish, and you have other workers that are Albanian, and that really does kind of sum up what Hamtramck is about, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. We have Polish, Ukrainian, Serbian, Albanian, just to mention a few. We have, she likes to call herself a hillbilly from Kentucky. I mean, we're just the United Nations here.
And meantime, we know a lot of people in Southeast Michigan are going to make a point of stopping going to or from work or school and making a pilgrimage to Hamtramck for punchki.
We welcome them with open arms.
Sandy Bakich with the new Martha Washington Bakery in Hamtramck, turning out baked goods and punchki for at least 90 years and maybe even longer. Sandy, it was great talking with you. Thank you so much.
Great talking with you as well. Have a wonderful day.
Still to come, we'll wrap up our new music series with Joe Hertler and the Rainbow Seekers.
You do this because you have something that you think is special. And, you know, you think, hopefully, people will actually get something out of it when they listen to it.
That's in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Making economics interesting to kids. That's the goal of Michelle Belconi. She's a writer from Grosse Pointe Park, and she teamed up with renowned Reagan administration economist Arthur B. Laffer and Clinton Township artist Mark Kinsora. Together, they've created a friendly nuts and bolts guide to economics aimed at a young audience. Michelle is here with us now. Just where did this idea of the book called Let's Chat About Economics, where did it come from? I mean, when you think of kids' books, somehow economics isn't exactly top of mind.
I completely agree with you, and we have two children and had never had a book that discussed economics. But the idea came from seeing Dr. Laffer speak a few years ago in Detroit and having that feeling that I wish our children were there to see the presentation.
What was he talking about? What was it that fired you up?
Sure. He really just was talking about basic economic principles of supply and demand. And in his career and in his opinion, you know, politics wasn't really a factor. Economics is. And he went on to explain that, you know, he had voted for politicians on both sides of the spectrum and that, you know, economics was what we really needed to understand. So I was always open to new ideas, but this one really hit home. I wouldn't say that I immediately suggested the book idea to Dr. Laffer. I noodled on it for a while, kind of had to overcome some confidence issues to really build myself up and send him a letter with an idea.
And what reaction did you get from him?
You know, I got an immediate reaction from him. He was very positive, and he's a grandfather to many, even a great-grandfather now. And he said, you're right. Kids absolutely can understand economics. And we took off from there.
who did what? Did he suggest economic concepts and phrases? Tell me how you did this with him.
Sure. So once he, you know, wrote back and basically said, game on, let's do this, I sent over some ideas that I had. And ultimately, we felt that the best introduction of economics was to explain it with everyday scenarios. So children wouldn't have to make a leap or an inference. We absolutely agreed the word widget would not be in the book. And so instead, we came up with four, you know, really relatable scenarios. And then we mapped the economic terms that we wanted for each story and then started writing.
What would you say are the big messages and the big lessons in this book?
Certainly, basic economic principles like scarcity, supply, demand, diminishing returns, and opportunity cost. But also, we're hoping that kids begin to see the value of themselves. If they can understand the value and increase in price of red roses in the month of February, we're also hoping that they can see themselves as a scarce and unique resource that has tremendous value.
Why is that important for them?
That's important because the way they view themselves will dictate the choices that they're making in life.
And they'll be informed. Give me just a for instance. Take one of the stories in your book and how it ties into a concept. Give me four example.
Sure. For example would be our family trip chapter. And it's a very snowy weather, much like we're experiencing now. And the kids in the family really are trying to convince their parents to go on a tropical vacation. That's what they need. That's what everyone else does. But mom says not so fast. And so mom decides this is an opportunity to talk about diminishing returns and ask the children to find a way to take a trip seeking the warmest temperature for the least expense. And so the kids go through several scenarios, you know, driving several days for only maybe 2 days at a beach and then having to come back. Of course, they would like to take an airplane ride, and there's a huge cost associated with that. And that's kind of a fun way that we talk about diminishing returns and opportunity costs in the book.
It certainly is much more enlightening than the I want it all and I want it now mindset that so many people and kids live with today.
Well, it's true. And, you know, letting kids operate under that belief system isn't going to serve them in life. And it's best to talk with them and really form this connection now so that there's not some big financial emergency. And that's when you decide to talk about the terms.
So who would you say age-wise that Let's Chat About Economics, Basic Principles Through Everyday Scenarios, who would it be aimed at?
We really wrote the book for families with elementary age students, and specifically I would say 3rd, 4th, and 5th grade. We've received feedback that a lot of parents find that their children are reading it by themselves, which I think is great, but the idea was that families, be it parents or grandparents, would connect with kids through this book on economics, you know, like having a conversation that maybe you never would have had before.
Let's Chat About Economics is available on Amazon, and you can find out more on letschataboteconomics.com. Michelle Balcony, pleasure to talk with you, and good luck with the book. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Joe Hertler and the Rainbow Seekers know how to put on a good show. When members of the six-piece band perform live, they wear Hawaiian shirts, fur coats. The saxophone player likes to wear a birch bark suit. And Joe Hertler, namesake of the band, likes to wear the state flag like a cape, or maybe he'll throw on rainbow angel wings. But as Stateside's Emily Fox has learned, it's not just the clothes that'll keep you on your toes.
Joe Hertler and the Rainbow Seekers is releasing their latest album, Terra Incognita, today, and each track has its own personality and flair. Let's do a quick lightning review. We've got some indie rock represented.
This is your story. You see your scars.
A lullaby.
Between the space of two eyes.
Some dance pop. Toss in some funk and soul.
I swear I could not fake it. Heavy is overrated.
And let's throw a little cherry on top with some doo-wop.
Oh, I love you. Yes, I love you. But I need something.
I'm now joined by frontman, singer-songwriter Joe Hertler and bassist and album producer Kevin Pritchard. And Kevin, you and Joe have been playing in this band together for 4 years, and you've been mixing, mastering, and producing albums with Joe Hertler and the Rainbow Seekers under your music collective, Vigor Brush Media. And you started Vigor Brush a few years ago in Lansing as a way to promote the music scene in mid-Michigan. Basically, you bring together a group of bands, you help promote each other, you borrow each other's equipment, you help record each other's music, play shows together. You basically create something bigger than what indie bands can do on their own. Kevin, you still produce this album through Vigor Brush Media, but you guys hopped on a more formal label for the first time ever. Tell us more about this label and why you made the switch.
We recently were picked up from a subsidiary of Universal Music Group. It's called Bad Mascot Records. It's a brand new label. It's a brand new idea, which is super exciting. We're really into the idea because it's different than sort of the old record label model. It's taking a lot of what's good about the new media with the internet and different ways to spread your music and network, and combining it with the connections and network of the old media. So it's a great opportunity for us in that sense.
Give me an example of how they do that.
Yeah, so it's a connection of probably 60 different campuses. What they're doing is they're building a network of small, Bigger Brush Media-esque type networks that we're going to be connected into. If we need to play shows, we can connect to them in their local area, and they'll help us out. They'll help us find support talent to play with us. And beyond that, it's the old world Universal Music Network as well. So what that means is if we need help with radio promotion, getting on festivals, possibly renting a studio for our next project, we can call up Universal and they will be happy to help us out with that. So it's really the best of both worlds.
And tell us a little bit more about how they work a lot with college students with this label.
They have these representatives set up across campuses nationwide, and they kind of can put together street teams for you. They help promote, help find, you know, supporting bands to play with you. In some cases, they'll even set up listening parties if you're not, you know, coming to actually play a show at their campus.
And what's really cool from our perspective is it's people that care so much about music. And it's, you know, like I said, it's like the Bigger Brush Media collectives of the area. These kids want to be a part of the music industry. They want to help music that they think is good, and they want to support us, we hope.
Yeah, right.
So, Kevin, when you announced that this album would be released, you said you spent more time and effort in the 2 years producing this album than you did getting your entire degree from Michigan State University. You said you slept on the floor a few times in your workspace.
Yeah.
And you said that some people might think you're crazy when you release this album, you'll also be releasing it on Spotify, where you hardly get any revenue generated from people listening to your music. What's your response to that?
I think it's good is my response to that, and I want it to get out. And that's – when it comes down to it, you don't do this because you want to get paid. Like, yeah, it's great if you can support yourself in the end, but you do this because you have something that you think is special. And, you know, you think hopefully people will actually get something out of it when they listen to it.
I'm speaking with Kevin Pritchard and Joe Hertler of Joe Hertler and the Rainbow Seekers, and let's listen to a clip from another track off of your latest album. This song is called Hometown.
You were the place that wrote the story. You gave love so long before me. Did you bring me back? You need a right now. In a cool window. You need a right now. I don't want to.
Joe, tell me what this song's about.
It's just sort of about how all these different experiences and things you know, especially things that have happened in the place that you grew up, kind of all culminate to, you know, to represent who you are and craft who you are. And it's sort of like a thank you letter to the state of Michigan. the places that I grew up. And I'm just sort of saying thank you. Thanks for supporting me, and I'll try to do the best that I can with all of this.
And I really appreciate that both of you guys are big champions of Michigan. I mean, Joe Hertler, a lot of your songs are about Michigan. And Kevin, I remember interviewing you on my first assignment as an intern at Michigan Radio about Bigger Brush Media. And you were working with Bigger Brush Media in Lansing. And you said a lot of your friends had moved off to L.A. They wanted to do the music industry where the music industry was. But you wanted to stay in Lansing after graduating from MSU because you believed in potential in that area. And you wanted to, you know, stay true to the area and kind of cultivate it a little more. But you guys have also said that the Michigan community has also been a champion for you guys as well and what it is that you guys do. Can you tell me more about that?
They have been the biggest champions for us. Like every time we play hometown, as long as we're in the state of Michigan, you can feel it. It feels different. It's a really cool experience. As far as actually supporting us, the people have been incredible. Like anytime we do anything, the response and the support that we receive, we just like post. We're like, oh, we're going to release an album, and like, you know, hundreds of people share it and tell their friends about it and claim they're going to buy 40 albums just to, you know, boost our set. Like, it's crazy. The people are, they've been incredible, and we would be absolutely nothing without them at this point. We'd still be a bunch of weird dudes hanging out in, you know, a house in Lansing playing music together. Like, it would be a very different story.
You know, Lansing's not typically a place that's, like, associated with having like, a super strong music scene. You know, that credit usually goes to, like, Grand Rapids, Detroit, and Ann Arbor. But it's kind of, I feel like, as we've grown, we've become more than just, like, a Lansing band. It's like we are a Michigan band. You know, I personally have lived all over the state and feel home in many places. And have friends in many places that just make it feel even more like home. So it's just a great feeling to kind of see the state, you know, join on this adventure with you.
I'm speaking with Joe Hertler and Kevin Pritchard of Joe Hertler and the Rainbow Seekers. Let's listen to the last track on your latest album. This song is called Red Wings.
Left you standing in a cold place. Left you standing in the dust. Oh no. I can only imagine what you went through when you sold your faith for luck. You walked around in the shadows in the fog. Their bony fingers always covering their eyes. They kissed your lips and put a bag over your body. But you never let them bury your mind. Just keep laughing it off. Just keep laughing it off, just keep laughing it off, just keep.
So that line, I kissed your lips and put a bag over your body, but you never let them bury your mind. That line really stuck with me. Tell me more about that.
Oh, gosh.
What's the story you're trying to tell here?
So I wrote that song following the death of my grandmother. But I was, like, really struggling to write music about that because I do very much write songs as know, a way to cope and to make sense of things. But it wasn't really up until the death of my drummer's father that, like, some of these songs about my grandmother really became full circle. And that was a couple months later. And I think it was really tough for all of us in the band. I think we all really very much internalized the death of Rick's father. And these songs just started, like, pouring out. And that was one of them. And it's just, you know, another song about impermanence, but that how the way people kind of affect you in your life leads to a sense of permanence in the way that, you know, they live through you as time goes on.
I've been speaking with Joe Hertler and Kevin Pritchard of Joe Hertler and the Rainbow Seekers. Their latest album, Terra Incognita, was released today. More information can be found at joehertler.com. Joe and Kevin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Emily.
Thanks for having us, Emily.
You are beautiful and strong.
Fox has been checking out new music from Michigan. And in case you missed any of the interviews in her series, just head over to michiganradio.org and click the link that says Stateside. Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. Still to come, red wine and refrigerators. Many say the two don't mix, but our chief wine and food critic will be here to set the record straight. That's in 15 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The White House begins its summit on countering violent extremism today. The conference comes in the wake of deadly attacks carried out across the globe. The shockwaves over the videotaped murder of a Jordanian Air Force pilot were especially deep in southeast Michigan because he has relatives here. A large crowd recently gathered to mourn the pilot and call for an end to the self-declared Islamic State. They were from Metro Detroit's Arab American community. Osama Sablani is with us now. He's the publisher of the Arab American News. It's the biggest and most widely circulated Arab American publication in the U.S. Welcome back to the program, Osama.
Thank you for inviting me, Cindy.
Who spoke to the crowd at that rally in Livonia?
Well, I was one of the speakers. There were a couple imams, clergy from the Muslim faith, and two from the Christian faith, and also the Council of Jordan in Detroit. He's an honorary position, but he spoke as well. And also the head of the American Jordanian Society and a few other community leaders from different backgrounds. The message was that we all stand together, that what happened with Muad al-Kasasibi, the pilot, it happened before to other soldiers in Lebanon, to other people like in the reporters in Japan, to hundreds, to thousands, to tens of thousands of Iraqi and Syrians and Yemenis and Lebanese. So we all are united against the ISIS and against their criminal activities. They do not represent Islam. They do not represent Christianity. They do not even represent humanity. I don't know how these people came about. I have been in business for 30 years doing, reporting from the Middle East and here from around the community. I'm totally shocked, totally, and in disbelief that people like this exist in the world.
You know, Osama, you've been publishing the Arab American News, I know, for some 30 years. So much history has happened in the Middle East at that time. I remember speaking with you during Operation Desert Storm, the Gulf War in 1991, and thinking of what has happened in the years then and now. The Middle East is a region that's virtually synonymous with turmoil and bloodshed. What do you say to those who connect the Arab American community and perhaps even blame Muslims and Arab Americans for what ISIS is doing now?
I say that, you have to first know the reality of the situation on the ground, that Arabs and Muslims are the first victims of these animals. They have killed more Arabs and more Muslims than they have killed any other nationality. These are criminals. These are barbarics, and they have nothing to do with Islam, nothing to do with the Arab community or the Arab people. 350 million Arabs are in the Arab region, and they are very few people. But unfortunately, they are financed, well-financed. In your introduction, you made some important statement that needs to be addressed. First, these people, they have the money, the technology, the information, the weapons, and the logistics in order to conduct such highly expensive operations. They have occupied areas. They have controlled large space, large areas in Iraq, large areas in Syria. They're exporting oil and selling them in the market. We have to realize that there are people behind these people, and we have to know who they are and why are they doing what they're doing. When they videotaped in a very sophisticated way the burning of the pilot, Jordanian pilot, what they were trying to say, and they spread it over the internet, they were trying to tell us that we are brutal, we are going to kill anyone who stands in our face. Fortunately, the video present different views of what's happening. When you see the Jordanian pilot standing like an arrow, not bending, even he was starved 5 days before, and he was, you know, assaulted and beaten. But the spirit of the Jordanian pilot was stronger than all their brutality. And that is what we need to do. We need to stand against these people. We need to point out who is behind them, who is financing them, who is giving them the support to do what they're doing. They're not alone. Mm. But I can tell you, the Arabs and the Muslims are their victims. They're not their supporters.
So we saw in this gathering in Livonia a very unified response from the community, interfaith speakers. So this unified response to the lieutenant's murder. Some might want to pose the question, Osama, why did that not happen back in August when the very first video was released showing James Foley beheaded? That was the first of what's become a horrifying string of videos.
We were unified. And we condemned it, and we took it to the streets of the city hall, you know, in front of the city hall in Dearborn. And we had a candlelight vigil, and all religious leaders were there, all community leaders were there from all walks of life. We did not get the coverage at that time. We got it today. You know, we have a public relations problem. I mean, we need to talk to the media more. The media need to put us in good light sometimes, not only when we are in a crisis. I think that this community has done a lot to condemn ISIS. We've issued so many condemnations of what ISIS has done in Iraq, killing the Christians, and Syria, destroying the churches and burning churches in Egypt as well. We need to tell the world that we totally condemn it. There is no excuse or an explanation for this other than they are a bunch of animals and they are spreading fear and destruction.
Which is exactly their goal.
Yeah, they're destroying the culture, the beautiful culture of the Arabs. The history, you know, there are cities that are 5,000 years old that they are destroying. These are animals. These are not human beings. You know, you're insulting animals when you say that. They are criminals beyond your mind belief. I have never seen anything like this, even in movies, what they have done. And someone is financed. Something is happening.
Something sinister.
Radicalization process that has been going on for years. And we have been talking about this over and over to U.S. officials, to Arab officials. We have been saying that the money that is being spread around to these people from the Saudis needs to stop. Saudi Arabia, they produced the 19 people who came and bombed us on September 11. Mm-hmm. We need to know that there is a radicalization process that has been supported by the Saudis for a long time. These people do not believe in the other point of view. It's their way or the highway. They do not believe that Islam should be any different than the way they think. The Wahhabis, the idea of the Wahhabis being the only people that believe in Islam the way they believe in Islam and anybody else is wrong, is very, very disturbing. I have witnessed it myself when I traveled to Saudi Arabia. When they say that no churches, no other mosque should be erected in Saudi Arabia, we should not have allowed this to happen. We should not have continued to say that the Saudi kingdom is a friend of the United States just because of the oil. We have sacrificed the well-being of humankind because we needed the oil. We could have had the oil and not all of this with it. We need to point out the radicalization process that started almost half a century ago. It is producing right now chaos in the world.
And we're seeing these young, disaffected young Muslims all around the world from hearing a very skillful message through social media. ISIS is using it very skillfully to recruit. You got to wonder, what will it take to keep these young Muslims from hearing the message and hopping a plane to get to Syria to join the jihadists?
What we need to do is we need to go to the source. In my opinion, treating symptoms is not the way to do it. You know, you have to go in and see what is behind those symptoms. What are the causes of those symptoms? We need to really sit down and talk frankly about what is happening and why these people have been radicalized like this. We have been supporting regimes that they have been brutal to their society. And on the other hand, we have been supporting regimes that they are very radical in their thinking. We have allowed them to do what they wanted to do. Look what they're doing right now to a blogger in Saudi Arabia. They're whipping him, you know. And now Prince Charles and everybody else is begging them to stop. We should say, if you give him one more whip, we're going to wipe you out. Or we're going to stop dealing with you or talking to you or boycotting you. We need to take a stronger position on human rights issues. And we should not be selective in our views and how we see human rights. Now, human rights in Saudi Arabia is one thing. In Bahrain, it's okay. Or in Israel, it's okay. No, it should be across the board.
Osama, if we're able to end the ISIS reign of terror and crush ISIS, and then what? Will another group rise to take its place?
As long as the source is open, we have to close all the sources. We have to close the finances, the way of thinking, the way of teaching this kind of, you know, mentality. This is not coming from vacuum. It's coming from somewhere. You know, they have been educated, brainwashed, and taught for years, for decades. I have witnessed this. I have seen it. I have written about it. But nobody was listening. Even radicalization is not limited to the Middle East. It's all over the region because of the internet and because the Saudis had the money to spread their message across the world. They had the money. They can finance things. You know, they can, you know, the Al-Azhar, which is the head of the Sunni or the Muslims in the world in Egypt, they are really educating imams and religious leaders, and they're sending them all over the world, but they don't have the money to pay them. So who comes out and pay them? The Saudis. And whoever pays dictates. And that's how we see all these mosques around, you know, that they're dominated by the Saudis. They're teaching these hardliners, you know, and teaching them and radicalizing them.
And then meantime, you're seeing, let's say, the American public, who kind of make the mistake of viewing the Arab American as one amorphous group, all with the same views and priorities. So we're seeing that splashing back on people who...
Well, but I can't blame the American people for the ignorance. I'm sorry to say that because I'm speaking to a media and I'm a media. The media. The media should educate the American public that, no, this is not the case. This issue that we're suffering from and we're witnessing, the Arabs and the Muslims are suffering the most. Their homes are destroyed. Their lives are destroyed. Their kids don't go to school. They have no health system. They don't have any sanitation. They don't have any life. They are being killed and butchered by these animals. And we are looking at them and accusing the victim of doing all these things. This is not true. It's not fair. It's not fair. No, the Muslims and the Arabs are against this kind of behavior. But they do not have the power to change. They don't. They don't. We made a mistake when we went and invaded Iraq in 2003. And I said that because when you do this, you destroy the infrastructure of a country. Who would take over? Special interests. In this case, extremists. And that's what happened. That's what happened in Iraq. That's what's happening in Yemen. And that's what's happening right now in Syria. So we also take the blame as a country for our policy in the region that is confused. It is not focused. We don't know what we want. We're spreading chaos in the region because our vision is blurred, is not clear what we need to do in the region. So we have to revisit our policies.
Osama Sablani is the publisher of the Arab American News. You can find it online at arabamericannews.com. Osama, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside. I know we'll be talking again.
Thank you, Cindy. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Can you refrigerate red wine? Better put, should you refrigerate red wine? And if so, when and why? Let's turn to our Detroit Magazine's chief wine and restaurant critic, Chris Cook. And Chris, some might be clutching at their pearls right now, but is it okay to keep a red wine chilled?
Well, there's a reason that the wine cellar exists, has always existed, and that is to keep wine at a cooler temperature than you would normally get in the other areas of a house or of in a restaurant. And it's applicable to red wine as easily as it is to white wine. They just generally do better. They taste better. And, of course, white wine we know about chilling, but red wines we don't do it that often, and I think we should.
And when we say chilling, how long should we be parking these wines in our refrigerators before we open them?
Well, I wouldn't say you want to put it in more than about a half hour. If it was a temperature issue, I'd say you want to take it down to probably 45 to 55 degrees, which is also where a lot of white wines are taste their best, at around the same temperature. Now, there are exceptions. For instance, Bordeaux, I tend not to chill because of the composition of the wine. The wine is just a different character, and it doesn't come across as well as if you chill Pinot Noir a little bit. And I think it's got to do very often with the acidity in the wine. The acidity takes chill and likes chill and gives you a better wine. This is a heresy in a way to a lot of people, I realize, but I think that one of the big problems that we face today with wine and the need for chilling reds particularly is that the wines today are made so much more heavily than they were made in the past. They're thicker, and I find that they're indistinguishable from one from another very often. So when you chill it, it just brings out more of the fruit character and it balances the wine up a little bit with a little bit of acidity and a little crispness.
And switching to whites for a moment, we all get that whites are best when they're chilled, but can we over-chill? How long is too long to keep that bottle of white in the refrigerator? I know some people that keep a bottle handy in the wine section in the door of their refrigerator.
Oh, I do too. And I think over-chilling would be a little bit north of the freezing point.
Okay. You know, with some,
I'm being a little facetious when I say that because there is a point at which you begin to kind of bruise the fruit with the cold, and you don't want to really do that. But as a general rule with whites, I would say anywhere from 40 to 55 degrees. With Chardonnay, you want to go more to the 50-degree end. With Sauvignon Blanc and Riesling and some of the other grapes, you can go cooler, of course. Then there's sparkling wine, which needs to be chilled even down a little further than that. So,
one other question, not so much about refrigerating, but it occurred to me as I was thinking of my bottles of wine, and we've got the expert here. Let's find out. For either whites or red, let's say we open a bottle, have a glass, maybe two, and then stick the cork back in. How long do we have to polish off the rest of the bottle before it is not very good?
That's very dependent on the wine itself. And I don't think you can really say that there is a limit in time for that kind of thing. But overall, I would tend to say that at a week, it's really heading the other side of the mountain.
What about reds?
Reds, I have never really tested them out over time, but I wouldn't do it for more than a day or two. I think they are somewhat more sensitive to cold and subject to change. But I'll tell you this, they're more sensitive to heat than they are to cold. You get them up around 80 degrees and they're going to really go a lot faster. But what's been known for a long time is that cellar temperature, quote unquote, is the best thing for both wines. And that really runs the gamut from, I'd say, about the high 30s up to about 55 degrees, 60 at the top end for storage. But, you know, you'd want to get it out and let it sit a little bit. It's going to, as soon as you uncork it and you're in a regular room, the heat of that wine is going to increase and the internal temperature is going to increase and its characteristics are going to start to change.
Well, now you make me want a really lovely bottle of a young Pinot Noir. Thanks a lot, Chris. The care and feeding of our wines, if you will, with our Detroit Magazine's chief wine and restaurant critic, Chris Cook. As always, thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you.
And that's it for today's program, which was directed by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark, and our engineer is Peg Watson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.